We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. As usual, plenty to shoehorn into 59 minutes. Starting with, we're just a few days away now from the final deadline for the recall election for
Shama Sawant. Yeah, it is the final weekend for people in District 3 to mark their ballots and drop them in a drop box or in the mail. I would suggest in a drop box if you live in District 3.
Yeah, this especially with the holiday season, mail delivery is going to be very slow.
Yeah, and yes, and you want to make sure that your vote gets counted. The news yesterday was that there were a lot of folks who had already marked their ballots and turned them in. So a lot of very early voting in this recall election. But we, again, like with the November election, we're probably not going to know the results for at least a week after the ballots.
Yeah, bear in mind the history of Sawant elections is that you can't go by the election night results because it's going to take she will gain ground or increase her lead depending pretty steadily for at least a week. Because her supporters tend to vote late and the people who hate her tend to vote early. So bear that in mind on election night.
So with that in mind, let's take a look at the money that's been spent in this election.
One more point on that.
Uh-huh.
When the Seattle Times declares her the loser on Wednesday morning, don't take their word for it. Look at the numbers.
Yeah. Okay. So there are two groups that support the recall effort that have raised money. One is the Recall Sawant campaign, and the other is a PAC called A Better Seattle. Together, they've raised $968,118 as of last night's tally on the Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission website. The top contributors to the recall effort are a who's who of real estate developers, property owners, and construction companies in Seattle, with a few other big businesses and their executives donating as well. For the Recall Sawant campaign itself, 40% of those contributions are from District 3, so not a majority. 18% are from outside the city limits, and 17% are from District 7. That's downtown, Belltown, South Lake Union, Queen Anne, and Magnolia. Okay, so a lot of the downtown folks have contributed heavily to the Recall Sawant campaign. Much smaller amounts are from other districts in the city. So around 3 to 5% of the contributions are from other districts, except for District 4, which makes up 8% of the contributions. And District 4 is the U District, Laurelhurst, Ravenna, Wallingford, et cetera. And some of those areas, some of those wealthy properties along Lake Washington. Now the PAC that is supporting the recall effort, it's called A Better Seattle, has raised about $184,000 of that $968,000 total. 30% of their contributors come from District 3, but that was only the second largest source. The single largest source of their contributions are from District 7. That's, again, the downtown area, right? They received 16% of their contributions from outside Seattle and 10% from District 4. The other districts had very nominal numbers of contributors ranging from 1 to 3% of their donation. Okay. So very clearly here, it's the Downtown Business Association, it's real estate developers, it's property owners and managers and construction companies that want her out of office. Now, the Shama Solidarity Campaign has raised almost as much, $953,174. So they are comparable. They're neck and neck in terms of their fundraising and campaigning.
And that's really impressive because it's almost all grassroots.
It is. Now, her supporters include local progressives, labor union members, and out-of-town members of various socialist groups, not all of them from her own socialist group, a lot of whom have made multiple small donations in the $50 to $100 range every month over the past year. 54% of her donors are from outside Seattle. That is a big chunk. So it shows you the high profile that she's had nationwide as a socialist city council member. 24% of her contributions are from District 3. The rest are spread between the other districts, with a sizable chunk from District 2, and that's South Seattle. So if contributions from outside District 3 and PAC money are removed from the calculation, here's where the two sides stand. So if, for example, only people living in District 3 could contribute to the campaigns, the Recall Sawant campaign would have $313,000 and the Shama Solidarity campaign would have $228,000. So still, over $500,000 in campaign money for a single district race in the city of Seattle. That's, to me, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And if you add up all sources of money from both campaigns, the total spent in this one election so far is $1,921,292. Just let that sink in for a minute. And it's not even a mayoral race. And I look at those numbers and I think, what a waste. What a waste.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and then if she stays in office, Sawant will still have to turn around and run for re-election in less than 2 years.
Yeah.
Assuming she wants to run for re-election.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so let's talk about the race for the next city council president.
Okay.
There are rumors flying at City Hall that Lisa Herbold and Deborah Juarez are both campaigning. They're council colleagues for the position of president of the city council. The current president, Lorena Gonzalez, is going to be out of office on December 31st. She decided not to run for her seat in order to run for mayor, and Sarah Nelson will be replacing her come January 1st. Typically, a senior council member would be up for the 2 year stint as city council president. The most senior council member right now is Shama Sawant, but of course she's kind of busy right now, right? That leaves Lisa Herbold and Deborah Juarez. Teresa Mosqueda appears to not be interested, and I think she probably wants to continue in her role as head of the budget committee. Where she has a large amount of influence. Typically, the chair of the budget committee is not also the council president at the same time, since that would involve, I think, way too much work for one person. The other council members, Tammy Morales, Alex Peterson, Andrew Lewis, and Dan Strauss, are all recent arrivals to the council. So they're not naturally considered good candidates to run the city council. So it'll be interesting to see who wins that battle between Herbold and Juarez. Herbold has the votes among the current council members, but I'm not sure if the voting is going to be done by them or by the new council, which will include Sarah Nelson in place of Lorena Gonzalez. And if we think about the potential for Shama Sawant losing on Tuesday or a week from Tuesday, she may not be on the council starting next year. And it would take a while for the city council to find and appoint a replacement for her if she isn't on the council come January 1st. So Herbold's obvious supporters include Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, and Teresa Mosqueda, and Sawant if she stays on the council. Deborah Juarez's obvious supporters are Sarah Nelson and Alex Peterson. But if Dan Strauss also supports her, we're not sure who Dan Strauss might support, and Sawant leaves the council, then neither candidate would have five votes. And it could be a while before a new person, as I said, is appointed to replace Sawant to be the tiebreaker. So it'll be interesting to see how it all falls out if there's a consensus candidate among those two for city council president, or if we go into the new year without knowing who is going to be running the council and there's a split vote.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's kind of an interesting thing to think about, I think.
Well, it's just a matter of time before the business community starts forming a pact to influence that as well.
Probably.
Yeah, I don't think you can. It's a vote taken by within the city council itself, but I'm sure they're doing their best by meeting with as many council members who will open their doors for them. Alex Peterson, for sure. Dan Strauss, maybe.
Yeah. Right. Well, so we'll something to look forward to in the coming year.
Yes.
All right. So let's move on to locally this week's police accountability related news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the family of Charlena Lyles won a $3.5 million settlement this week from the city of Seattle in their lawsuit, which has gone over 3 years, in the shooting death of Charlena Lyles in her own kitchen by two Seattle police officers in June of 2018. The lawsuit did not argue that the two officers, Jason Alexander and Stephen McNew, used excessive force. Instead, the lawsuit charged the two officers failed to perform their duty by not having a de-escalation plan when they entered her apartment. And and the two officers knew that she had mental health issues because there'd been a previous run-in with a Seattle police officer where Charlena Lyles had pulled a pair of scissors on him and threatened to stab him. So there was a record, and they knew before they went into the apartment that she had mental health issues, but they went in without a plan. And they, even though they knew she could become violent. In addition, neither officer had a working taser, which is department policy. To de-escalate violent confrontations, officers are required to carry a taser so that their only option isn't to just pull their gun and shoot. One officer, Officer McNew, who was considered the experienced one, also turned his back to Charlena Lyles several times during the situation. In addition, a diagram of the incident shows that one of the officers stood near the doorway of her apartment while the other officer went right into Lyles' kitchen and allowed her to get between him and the door. So essentially, he allowed her to box him in, which created a higher risk situation when Lyles did pull a knife. Okay. McNew never faced any punishment for the shooting, and the OPA eventually suspended Anderson for 2 days for not carrying his taser with him. But the OPA ruled that the shooting was justified. I think that's a big example of why so many people in Seattle are not satisfied with the current police oversight system. Also this week, I want to mention that the Office of the Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department released its year-long audit of the police discipline process in Seattle, particularly what happens after the OPA concludes its investigations. In other words, does the oversight process lead to real discipline within the ranks of the Seattle Police Department? And the answer is no, it doesn't. Even though the OPA can make suggestions of how an officer should be disciplined when he or she breaks the rules, and whenever the OPA does find that they broke the rules, instead of saying that, yes, that shooting was justified, or yes, that use of force was justified, as they often do, it's ultimately up to the police chief to decide on what the discipline will be, not the OPA. Okay. Between the years 2018 and 2021, the OIG found that the police chief during those years, that would be Carmen Best, and Adrian Diaz and any interim folks who were running the department in between those two, the OIG found that the police chief chose the least severe form of discipline in nearly half of all cases in which the OPA recommended a range of consequences. Oh, yeah, I know. In addition, if a chief decides to completely ignore the OPA's recommendations, he or she is not required to explain why they chose something much less severe than the range of consequences recommended by the OPA. Okay. Now, there's also the problem of how the OPA comes up with their range of consequences, which are usually based on prior cases. Some cases go back a decade or more that they're using to base their range of recommendations on. Citizens in Seattle have long complained that the Seattle Police Department hasn't adequately disciplined officers for misconduct in the past. So basing new cases on past decisions and the disciplining of officers on past decisions in which officers were not disciplined is a terrible pitfall in the whole oversight process. In reviewing the cases of individual officers disciplined for misconduct, the auditors found that officers who were suspended and weren't supposed to be working were nevertheless still able to work overtime. Okay. Okay. Not just able to come into the office and work, you know, or go out and work on things like special events and directing traffic and so forth. They were able to work overtime, right? And some who were suspended without pay were able to work enough overtime while they were suspended. Yes, I know. While they were suspended to make up for their lost pay. Okay. In addition, disciplinary problems are never taken into account when officers are evaluated for promotion. So again, it just means that the disciplinary process is a complete joke, right? At least the supervisors, the management at the Seattle Police Department view the disciplinary process as a complete joke. And,
so they can tell the public, this officer has been suspended without pay.
And he'll be out on the street working overtime doing something like working at a Seahawks game or directing traffic for a special event.
But if he's working on the street, mm-hmm. he's still got his service gun, right?
Yeah, well, he's still in uniform and still a Seattle police officer. And because right now those are the only folks who can do that kind of work, right? And the city council has been trying to work with the Seattle Police Department, with the mayor and the chief of police in order to move that work to civilians.
Well, lucky we have a new mayor coming in who's going to insist on cleaning that stuff up in the new contract with
No.
Oh, never mind.
Right. So
I had a temporary fever dream there.
Right. So you know, we've talked about how there's a problem with the OIG not conducting proper oversight of the OPA like they're supposed to. And that the OPA, the cases that the OPA hears are often, they often come down on the side of the police officer who's accused of wrongdoing, because members of the OPA are themselves police officers or former police officers, and that the OIG is not exercising much oversight over them. And now the OIG looked at whether or not the Seattle Police Department management is taking the OPA's recommendations seriously, and the answer is no. They're finding creative ways to get around even the lightest of discipline, which is suspension without pay for a few days. So really, I'm kind of wondering if this audit report is going to influence the judge in who's overseeing the police oversight process here in the city of Seattle. So it'll be interesting to see if Judge Robart talks about this document, this audit document, when he rules in whether the city is making any progress in police reform in the coming months.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. I mean, there's problems. My understanding is there's also problems with one of the representatives that works with Judge Robart's in carrying out their duties. I know Carolyn Bick has written about that. Mm-hmm. So, and it's sounding like even in the community police commission that there are some issues with them following through and asking tough questions during their meetings and getting documents out to reporters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Well, you know, it's hard to know if some of that is COVID related because of the pandemic lockdowns, you know, and people not always being available to meet or having the technology to meet remotely, or to handle digital documents. You know, it's hard to know, or if that's just resistance among some members of those groups. We're several years out now from the start of this whole police reform project. Right. And typically when it first gets started, there's lots of energy and there's a lot of hope and people understand the terms of their job and do their best to fulfill it. And then you get years and years and years out from it and you start to have backsliders. Right. Or people who get on these commissions who are there to try to throw a wrench in the process. So
well,
I'm
know,
just kind of wondering
I know that,
if we're at that point.
I know that, I mean, a fair amount of the creation of these additional oversight groups is because the OPA itself was so inadequate. Mm-hmm. So that's been a problem ever since the OPA's creation. It's
when
been
it was inside the Seattle, when it was inside the Seattle Police Department and actually one of their departments.
Yeah, it's and that was created,
now.
What, 20 years ago now?
Mm-hmm.
And
a while
know,
back.
Yeah, and it was supposed to usher in this great new era of accountability, and of course nothing of the sort has happened.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I suspect this will be something we'll be continuing to report on.
To talk about, yes.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Very All right.
Good.
Well,
happy holidays.
Let's move on. Speaking of fiascos, let's move on to redistricting.
Yeah, the Washington Supreme Court this week, after just a few days looking at the case before them on the redistricting plan, decided on Friday that they would not review the work product of the Washington Redistricting Commission. Instead, they ruled that the commission did come up with two valid maps and that the maps can now be sent on to the state legislature for a vote.
And the Supreme Court does have the authority to review and modify those maps.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was declining to do.
Yeah, it was basically saying we're not going to step in between in this process and get involved. When the commission met, just to refresh people, when the commission met on the deadline day, November 15th, they caucused in private to make final changes to the two maps. Then just minutes before midnight, they voted to approve two maps, one for state legislative districts and one for U.S. congressional districts in Washington state. But those two maps existed in their minds only. There were no illustrations, drawings, or descriptions of the final two maps that they were voting on that the commission had before them or that they had released to the public.
And it took a couple of weeks to release it to the public.
Well, no, they had maps up on their website the next day. But that, again, that didn't meet the deadline date of November 15th. So, and in addition, because they had met in private, and only they knew what the parameters of the district boundaries were before they voted. Many people are saying this is probably a violation of the state's Open Meetings Act. Nevertheless, the state Supreme Court decided that it would not intervene, at least on the question of whether the commission came up with two valid maps. It's going to be up to citizens and citizen groups to file a lawsuit on the Open Public Meetings Act violation, which was not before the state Supreme Court in this case. And I can tell you that there is at least one lawsuit currently in the works and maybe another one following up on whether or not those maps are meet the standard under federal law.
Yeah, I think there will be a lawsuit from people in central Washington who had been hoping for district with a majority or a large plurality of Latino votes, since mm-hmm. Yakima Valley has a lot of Latinos in it. And
Yakima was split up pretty severely. I mean, one of the parameters that these maps are supposed to meet is that large communities are not supposed to be split up.
Yeah, and in this case, they were.
Yeah, and the folks on the commission were supposed to do their best to not split up, not necessarily take into account whether people would vote Democratic or Republican, but to take into account their ethnicity.
Typically the way this has worked, since the commission is evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, is that the trade-off is, well, you know, I'll protect your incumbent if you protect my incumbent.
Yeah.
And they create safe districts for each party. You know, even though that's not supposed to be a criteria, the real politic of it is that's how it's worked out.
That's how the
2010 census was adjudicated. And it looks like 2020 is going to be very similar. I can tell you there's going to be a lawsuit by Latino leaders from Central Washington who are really upset by how it played out this time.
Yeah,
because
lawsuit is definitely in the works. There's another one that I believe has already been filed that is challenging the way that the commission caucused and took their vote on materials that were drawn up in private instead of in a public meeting. And so none of the public knew what was being voted on.
Yeah, and the Latino leaders that area has been represented by Republicans for at least 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
So, they don't feel very well represented in Congress, and they would like to have different district boundaries, but that was not accommodated this time.
Yeah. Yep. That is the case. So that's the result of where the redistricting stands at this point. You can go to the Washington Redistricting Commission, Washington State Redistricting Commission website, and see the two maps that have been drawn up, if you're curious. Those maps will now go to the state legislature. The state legislature can make small changes to the districts, but they can't completely redraw the maps or make very large changes. So we will see what happens in the state legislature this coming spring.
Well, moving on, it appears Reagan Dunn is eyeing a different office than what he currently holds.
Yeah, Reagan Dunn is going to be running for his mommy's seat. He even called it that. I'm going to take back my mom's seat in Congress. Reagan Dunn, the Republican who sits on the King County Council, announced that he's going to run for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 8th Congressional District here in Washington State. That is the seat that his mother, Jennifer Dunn, held for six terms from 1993 to 2005. So you could ask why now, you know, and there are a couple of reasons why he feels that he is the best candidate to run on the Republican ticket. For one thing, aside from the fact that he's expressed interest in running in this district before because it was his mommy's seat, now there's a couple of new reasons. One is that the Washington State redistricting map that we were just talking about is going to redraws the boundaries of District 8 in a way that is expected to slightly favor Republican candidates. And the seat is currently held by two-term incumbent Kim Schreier, who beat moderate Republican Dino Rossi in her last race. Kim Schreier is the first Democrat in a long time to hold the seat in that district.
And it's a swing
district now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And she won that seat despite the 2010 redistricting, which added Kittitas County, in other words, Ellensburg, which is a Republican area, to try and help Dave Reichert retain that seat. And he probably was able to serve another three terms and fend off fairly strong challenges because of that. So apparently the 2020 redistricting expands on that east of the mountains section that has not historically been part of the 8th district. And that's what I'm looking at.
And I think it expands on it on this side of the mountains too, to try and add more suburban voters who could swing more towards the Republican Party. But the suburbs, out sort of outlying areas outside of Seattle are they contain a lot more people of color now than they used to. Okay, so they are leaning more towards the Democratic Party now. So we'll just have to see how it goes for Dunn when he runs.
Yeah, and that area has had explosive population growth. So I'm not sure how that compares with the overall population. Washington did not get any additional congressional districts this time. So the average population in a district is going to go up by a fair amount.
So I would think
that the east side Reagan, growth would outpace that.
Yeah, and Reagan Dunn has announced that his campaign manager is going to be the last Republican to hold that seat, which is Dave Reichert, right? Okay. So I think the other reason is that Dunn is now in the minority in the county council, which is now a majority of folks who lean towards the Democratic Party. Okay. I think nobody has ever accused Reagan Dunn of being a fighter. In fact, he recently has been criticized for being absent for far too many votes on the county council, the one county council member who tends to be absent when the council does take a vote.
Yeah. Dunn really for the last several years, because there's been, three, partisan Republicans on the council and six Democrats, and it's now 7-2. The criticism of him is he doesn't actually legislate anything. What he does is issue press releases, and he's really gone full Trump in the last couple of years.
Oh yeah. He's not a moderate Republican by any means anymore.
No. So, I think that'll be a fairly stark choice for District 8 voters.
Mm-hmm. Now, he's going to join two other Republican candidates in that race. One is a veteran named Jesse Jensen, who also ran in 2020 and didn't make it through the primary. And the other is Matt Larkin, who is running on the platform Make Crime Illegal Again, which is a redundant statement. I just want to point out illegal is the very definition of crime. But what he really means when he says that is that he wants to criminalize homelessness and poverty. That's the main pillar on his platform. Reagan Dunn, of course, is not a whole lot different in that regard. So that's the choice that voters will have in District 8. And of course, Reagan Dunn, unlike Lorena Gonzalez, is not going to be resigning his seat on the county council to make his run for District 8. He plans to still hold his seat in absentia, which is what he's been doing now, not showing up for votes and not doing much more except issuing press releases.
Moving on, Seattle Times this week had a fresh article out about the missing text messages.
People may remember that texts from Mayor Durkan to the police chief and other people involved in trying to decide what to do about the nightly confrontations between BLM protesters and East Precinct Police, that there was several weeks worth of texts that went missing, even though they should be part of the public record, and even though they would shed a lot of light on the decision-making that went into the decision, for example, to abandon the East Precinct last summer. Which led to Chop Chaz and, et cetera, et cetera. Those missing texts, the city attorney, Pete Holmes, hired a consulting group, called, the Crypsis Group, I believe is how it's pronounced, to analyze and investigate what happened to those missing texts and ideally try and recover them. Because of course those texts had to go to somebody also. It's been over a year since that investigation supposedly started. The city has, spent over $400,000 now on that investigation. It was due last July, so it's 5 months late at this point. And the city has spent about $200,000 of that money since the final product was supposed to be due. And we have no idea when it might be due. Now, with a new city attorney coming in, and Davison, and a new mayor coming in, Bruce Harrell, it's a fairly robust concern that any such investigation might simply be buried, even after $400,000 of taxpayer money has been spent. So, be very interesting to see if anything comes up from that in the next month before Durkin leaves office and Pete Holmes leaves office. But that seems to be in limbo right now. We're not hearing anything out of the city attorney's office. They say they have no idea when a final product might be available, or let alone made public. It was kind of a defining scandal of the Durkin era of, showing how committed she has been to lack of transparency and lack of accountability. Some of us would still like to know what she was saying.
I'm thinking maybe that they're hoping for a delay until she's out of office before the report gets issued.
Oh, no doubt. And then I think Harrell is likely to bury it, honestly.
Yeah.
And if he even sees it, if Ann Davison doesn't quash it, because she's certainly not interested in accountability either, at least from her public statement so far.
Well, maybe someone could ask Crypsis what's up with the report. Maybe they could text them the question.
Yeah, well, those texts seem to have gone missing, so... Crypsis isn't saying anything at this point. They're just cashing the checks.
Yes. All right. Well, how about this week's COVID pandemic news?
Okay. Well, the COVID news in mainstream media this week has been dominated by Omicron, the new variant first found in Botswana and South Africa that is spreading around the world. I'll talk about that in a minute, but first I want to remind people that we are in the middle of a major spike in new COVID-19 infections just from Delta. Forget Omicron for a minute. The numbers are steadily going up and have been for the last month, particularly in northern states where we're already having winter weather and people are indoors a lot. The new case infections are over 100,000 a day now in the United States, which is dramatically worse than it was a month ago or 2 months ago. We're seeing literally a doubling of cases over the last few weeks. And we're starting to get cold weather in Seattle now. It is pretty chilly out this morning and drizzly and blah, blah, blah. So people are inclined to stay indoors. Wear a mask if you are indoors. Protect yourself. And,
I kind of laugh about that because I was on my way home. I left work late last night walking home. And I saw a ton of people indoors, inside bars, clubs, restaurants, no masks, no social distancing. And I can just tell you that it is we're ripe for a spike in COVID cases, whether and, from Delta or Omicron.
Yeah, and Omicron, I'll get to that in a minute, but that is particularly worrisome with Omicron coming in. Mm-hmm. Omicron is now in 11 states, but Washington State is not one of those states. They are California, Colorado, Hawaii, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Utah. And the Minnesota case is particularly interesting because some of these cases are people who had traveled to Southern Africa. But some are not. Some are community spread. The one in Hawaii is. The one in Minnesota came from New York City, where he had been attending a 50,000-person anime convention. I don't know why $50,000 person indoor events are considered a good idea even before the advent of Omicron. It's a really bad idea, honestly. And of course we have cases in New York and New Jersey that are now tied to that convention as well. And the contact tracing effort has got to be Herculean to try and track down all those people who were at that event. But
yeah, and you know, Mike, I think you forwarded something to me this week about someone you'd seen on social media posting that he was waiting for a flight. And he heard a family talking about how members of their family had had a fever that morning, but they were still getting ready to board a plane.
Yeah, without masks, and they were sitting 10 feet away from him.
Mm-hmm. And so he went and he told someone, like a TWA security person. TSA security person, and then they came and had to ask those family members to leave, took them into a screening area. I just, you know, so this is what, you know, you're encountering. If you, for example, are vaccinated and you're thinking, oh, I can resume life as normal, you're encountering people who are not, a lot of people who are not vaccinated or their kids are not vaccinated. They're traveling when they're sick, and they're out there spreading the virus.
Yeah, and the numbers are going to go up dramatically, I think, in the next week because of Thanksgiving travel. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to get into Christmas and New Year's and the travel around those holidays. It's not a good time to be traveling, honestly. I know several people who had been planning to fly somewhere for the Christmas holidays who are rethinking that now. And, you know, Omicron was only found in the U.S. a couple of days ago, and it's already been found in 11 states. I think it's almost certainly in Washington state. We just haven't found it yet because genetic sequencing in the United States is not nearly as extensive as it is in a lot of other countries. That's just the reality. And what we're finding from the data from South Africa, where Omicron has really overtaken Delta, just in the last couple
very
of weeks.
Rapidly.
Yeah, it's a near vertical rise in the number of cases overall. You know, if you've seen those little line graphs over the past couple of years of you know, the different spikes, near vertical. It's extremely contagious. And, you know, comparing Omicron to the Delta spike in South Africa. South Africa was hit very hard by Delta when it first emerged. And, you know, comparing the first couple of weeks of Delta there with the first couple of weeks of Omicron now, we can see, you know, it's imperfect, and we're waiting on a lot of the lab data of, you know, questions like exactly how contagious is this thing? And
seeing is that it's hugely, it's much, much more contagious than the Delta variant, right?
Yeah, and I'll get to that. Mm-hmm. But questions like that, like, you know, is it more severe, less severe? We don't know yet. That's the big one. But one of the things that's coming out of the South African data is that people who have already had COVID are much more likely to be reinfected. And it is pretty much an article of faith among right-wingers in the United States that if you've been infected, you don't need to take a vaccine, you don't need to wear a mask or do any other kind of preventative thing, social distancing, any of that. You can just go back to your life as normal. Those days are over if they ever existed in the first place. The rise in cases, people thought that there might be over 10,000 new cases a day by next week. Yesterday, it had South Africa had 16,000 new cases. That's how quickly it's spreading.
Yeah, it went from like 4,000 new cases a day up to 16,000 new cases a day within like a week to 10 days. It was just an enormous rise very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So it's the one thing that we know, well, there's actually two things that we know about Omicron for sure, is that it spreads very quickly and is extremely contagious. And the other thing that we know is that even if you've had COVID-19 before, you can get reinfected with Omicron. The things we don't know is, does it make you as sick as, does it make you severely ill if you've been previously infected? And does it, and can you get it if you've been vaccinated? Those are the two things we don't know yet.
Yeah.
But I think it's safe to assume that getting a booster shot could help your chances, against Omicron.
Yeah, very much. And something like 20% of Americans have had booster shots so far. It's not nearly enough. Now, the other thing that comes out of the South African data comparing Delta to Omicron is the age distribution. Omicron tends to much more heavily infect younger people, which in the United States is people who tend not to be vaccinated. And the age group that is, exponentially worse for Omicron infections is kids under the age of 2, infants, are being heavily infected with Omicron. And of course, they can't be vaccinated. So, this is something that should worry any parent. Be very careful. This pandemic is not over, and take this, please, very seriously.
All right. Okay.
And this is why you're getting, scientists and public health people all over the world who are looking at a variant that hasn't spread in large numbers outside Southern Africa yet. And they're sounding the alarm. They're reacting to what data they see pretty much with a hair on fire response. It's bad. And we're going to be talking about this for a while.
I think it's important too, to, help people understand how the Omicron variant arose. Scientists believe that it would have been in a person who had COVID-19, but maybe wasn't sick from COVID-19. We know that you can test positive, you can be infected with the virus and not necessarily have any symptoms, but who had some of the virus in their lungs and then got the common cold at the same time.
The conjecture by South African scientists is that it was very likely somebody who was immunocompromised, or who had some sort of immune system issues, say somebody with HIV,
or who's older,
who was older and who harbored it for quite a while, which allowed all the
different we know that viruses exchange DNA, and we know that viruses can recombine, that two viruses can recombine and can exchange DNA in a host. And scientists are thinking that it's looking like Omicron may have captured a whole lot of mutations by recombining in someone who had lowered immunity, who was also infected with the common cold. And this is, I think, how a lot of viruses operate. And we know this is how a lot of viruses operate. And this is why it's been extremely important for everyone to get vaccinated. But of course, trying to explain this to the people who are vaccination holdouts has been really hard, I think, because they just don't understand what it means to allow viruses in the wild to continue to mutate like this.
I think it's explaining this kind of stuff to somebody who is willing to buy magic dirt is a Herculean
as a COVID
task.
Cure.
Yes.
Quote unquote cure. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, moving on to a different type of pandemic, another school shooting in Michigan.
Suburban Detroit, Oxford, Michigan, this week. 4 students were killed, another 7 are wounded. Some of those are still in the hospital in serious condition. This became quite the spectacle this week because yesterday we heard from the Oakland County District Attorney. This is, again, a northern suburb of Detroit, announcing involuntary manslaughter charges against both of the parents of the 15-year-old shooter. It has emerged, some of the details that the prosecutor shared yesterday, or I should say allegations, were simply horrifying. I mean, it really is a field guide to bad parenting and irresponsible parenting.
Yeah. If there was an award for stupidest parents of the year, I think James and Jennifer Crumbly would be the winners this year. Of course,
I think by unanimous acclaim, pretty much.
Yeah.
And so they fled yesterday, and they were arrested in an industrial building they were hiding in Detroit late last night. They have been arraigned this morning and pled not guilty, and they're in jail on $500,000 bail because they're considered flight risks. Of course, Detroit is right across the river from Canada, and that may have been where they were hoping to go, but of course, as soon as they withdrew money from their bank, which they did for $4,000.
And fled in their car and didn't bother to change vehicles. So, of course, the license plate gave them away.
Pretty much any kind of flight or border crossing would have been verboten.
Impossible, yeah.
You don't get the impression that the Crumblins are very bright. However, they were gun nuts. Authorities found a number of firearms in their home. Their son literally took the gun that he used in school out of an unlocked drawer in the master bedroom. The gun had been purchased a few days ago.
Yeah, let's go back a few days ago when his dad took the son to a gun store to buy him a Black Friday special. A 9mm Sig Sauer SP 2022 pistol. And that
Which, I'm gun, sorry, nobody needs a pistol like that.
Yeah,
I mean, that gun is very large caliber.
Yeah, it's a semi-automatic military grade and police grade pistol, which is very popular because it has a lightweight polymer frame. So it's really lightweight, which means it's great for a kid, right? Right? Now, the parents then decided
we should mention that kids under 18 in Michigan cannot legally own that kind of firearm.
Right, right. So the father had to buy it for him. And yet his mom then posted at the gun range, she took the son to the gun range to let him practice with his quote unquote new Christmas present. She posted about that on social media. Okay. So it was clearly bought for the 15-year-old. And kept in an unlocked drawer in the parents' bedroom where the 15-year-olds could access it at any time. Okay. And so, of course, the 15-year-old who owned the gun put it in his backpack and took it to school with him. Now, on the morning of the shooting, the school officials had called his parents in for an emergency meeting because a note had been found in their son's desk. On the note was a drawing of the gun. And the words, let's see, I have them right here. The words, "The thoughts won't stop, help me." Okay. The drawing also had a drawing of a bullet with the words "blood everywhere" on it. Okay.
And this is after the previous day, a teacher had caught the son scrolling through his phone looking for information on how to buy ammunition.
Yeah.
And his mother texted him once they were notified about that, saying, "You have to learn not to get caught."
Right, right. And so when the parents were called in for an emergency meeting and shown the drawing, they refused to pull their son out of school. They didn't want to take him to a counselor. And of course, they didn't mention to the school officials that Ethan had easy access to a gun at home, when in fact, actually Ethan, who was sitting in the next room, had the gun in his backpack at the time. So Ethan was eventually sent back to class. His parents gave him a little pat on the back. There was no search done of his bag. And then a few hours later, he walked out of a restroom at school and started shooting other students. Okay.
Randomly.
Yeah.
These were not necessarily other students that he knew.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's a pretty clear case there that the Michigan authorities have for charging the parents with involuntary manslaughter. The parents were clearly irresponsible, and clearly
grossly irresponsible.
Treating their son as a friend rather than as their child is, I think, grossly irresponsible parenting, as well as having unsecured guns openly available inside their house for their son and his friends to access whenever they wanted to. Okay.
Now, the parents might not have thought there was a threat, but a lot of the other students did. There were a number of students who stayed home from school on the day of the shooting because they had heard rumors that somebody was going to do something like this. So he was clearly talking to people about this as well.
Or people who knew him and were in his classes knew something was up and were telling other students that they were concerned. And of course,
yeah,
all of this happened, and there are four sets of parents who are mourning their children today. Two of whom were 17 years old, one was 16 years old, and the youngest was a girl of 14.
Okay. It's very, very sad.
Very sad. So we'll see. We'll see how the case goes against the parents. Seldom are parents charged in school shooting incidents. But I think it needs to happen more often, particularly in these instances where you can prove gross misconduct like this.
And we saw that kind of gross misconduct in the details that came out in a trial just a couple weeks ago with the Rittenhouse trial, where mom drove young Kyle across state lines with a weapon and dropped him off in a volatile situation. She should have been charged also, honestly.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, it's a major precedent, just the charging of the parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very curious about the outcome.
Yep.
Well, unfortunately, that's pretty much all the time we got for this week's uplifting stories.
Yeah. There was also a really bad police shooting in Tucson that people should have looked up.
Yeah.
A shoplifter in a wheelchair who was wheeling away from police, so there was no threat.
Yeah. Shot in the back 9 times.
Yep.
Or at least there was 9 shots, and he was shot in the back. I don't know how.
Yeah, no, he was shot 9 times. Yeah. And then he wasn't given first aid by the cop who had just shot him. The cop, went to handcuff him as he lay motionless on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Just awful.
Yeah.
All right. Well. Talk to you both at the same time next week.
Yeah, and yes, we'll bring you more holiday cheer.